with the native people, and they had a tree. I forget what it's called, a maypole tree.
Oh, yeah.
And they hacked it down. The story is the colonial leader hacked it down with his sword, and I think they cut off Thomas Morton's hair, and they sent him back to England anyway as a lesson, because there were defectors.
I think Benjamin Franklin was saying how difficult it was to get Indian children that they had educated to stay. The minute they got, they would leave, no matter how nicely they were treated. But it was the exact opposite. They had a hard time getting colonists to return when they went to. It was much better to live with the Indians, and they didn't want to come back.
I wish we could have started that about half an hour ago, but we are plumb out of time. And so I thank you so much, Jackie. Really appreciate it. And show up tomorrow evening at the First Unitarian Church for this panel that she's going to be on. Thank you, everybody, much. This is Paul Rowland for Wednesday Talk Radio. Stay tuned to KBOO.
Feeling crazier than hell. Got this time on my hands, and got you on my mind, and got nowhere else to go. The fires burn hot and cold. That's someplace in between the melt and the freeze. This need for reaching for you. You were all I could be. Now I'm here wearing alone. We were one, now I'm a ghost, falling from my place in the sun. It's dizzy.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Nosh for Nonviolence fundraiser on Thursday, October 22nd from 5 p.m. until midnight at participating Portland area restaurants. Nosh for Nonviolence is a collaborative fundraiser for two local domestic violence intervention agencies, the Portland Women's Crisis Line and West Women and Children's Shelter. Again, that's Nosh for Nonviolence fundraiser on Thursday, October 22nd from 5 p.m. until midnight. You can find the list of participating Portland area restaurants at kboo.fm. on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
October is Filipino American History Month to honor the moment in history when the first documented Filipinos on a Spanish galleon arrived in Morro Bay, California in October, 428 years ago. Tune in Friday night, October 23rd, from 6 p.m. to midnight, as KBOO airs music, interviews, and live programming that give voice to largely untold stories of Filipino Americans who have shaped American culture and the course of history. We'll hear from legends such as Joe Bataan and Fanny, as well as hip-hop artists like Bamboo and Rocky Rivera. That's Friday night, October 23rd, starting 6 p.m. to midnight at your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up now, Political Perspectives with host Linda Olsen-Osterlund. She interviews ACLU attorney Stephen Watt about their lawsuit against U.S. psychologists who designed and ran the CIA's torture operation. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, Flashpoints features a talk by noted author and radical historian Vijay Prashad on the Middle East. And at 11, it's the KBOO Food Show with Chris Siegel and Rachel Bennett.
The detainee is lying on a gurney that's inclined at an angle 10 to 15 degrees. A cloth is placed over the detainee's face. Cold water is poured on the cloth. The wet cloth creates a barrier through which it is difficult, or in some cases not possible, for the detainee to breathe. If the detainee makes an effort to defeat the technique by twisting his head to the side and breathing out the corner of his mouth, the interrogator may cup his hands around the detainee's nose and mouth, in which case it would not be possible for the detainee to breathe. Explained in the section 2340A.
memorandum. Pain and suffering is best understood as a single concept, not distinct concepts of pain as distinguished from suffering. Oh, suffering.
Good morning, and thank you for tuning in to KBOO. You're listening to Political Perspectives, and I'm your host, Linda Olson Osterlund. That music that you were hearing was Jonathan Mann singing his song Waterboarding. Is part of his work titled Torture Memos. The words you were hearing came directly from actual torture memos of the governments. And torture is our topic today, torture and accountability. Since the photos first emerged from Abu Ghraib, we in America have become aware that our government has engaged in torture in the so-called war on terror. Last December, the Senate's report on CIA torture finally came out. And this July, the American Psychological Association's eagerly awaited report on the involvement of psychologists in the U.S. torture program was released. Among the revelations was the role of psychologists James Mitchell and Bruce Jessen. These men devised the torture program, and that was known, and they experimented on prisoners to refine their techniques. If you're like me, you've been wondering, would there ever be any accountability for this policy of torture that our government has taken up and that these psychologists provided the methods to do? And I have not thought that we would be able to, but that's where my guest today comes in. His name is Stephen Watt. He's an attorney. He's actually senior attorney with the ACLU and a long record of being a human rights attorney as well. He is one of the attorneys on a new lawsuit that's been filed on behalf of three plaintiffs to sue the two men who devised this torture program. Welcome to KBOO, Stephen Watt.
Good morning.
I'm so glad you could join us today. Listen, let's start off right away with you just telling us about this lawsuit. Who are the plaintiffs and who are we suing and for what? But before you do that, let me digress for a second. I want to let people know that this will be a call-in show. We have Stephen with us for the full hour, and approximately around 9:30 the middle. I'll go ahead and open the phone lines for you to call in at 503-231-8187, and I'll give you that number again later. So Stephen, let's tell the audience, what is this lawsuit? Who are the plaintiffs? Who are you suing and what for specifically?
So in one word, what this lawsuit is about justice for survivors of the CIA's torture program. And in this lawsuit, we are suing James Mitchell and Bruce Jessen. And they are the two psychologists identified in the Senate torture report who designed and ran the CIA's torture program from 2002 until its end in 2009. They designed the program itself. They devised the torture methods. And those methods were specifically designed to psychologically destroy persons who the CIA had captured. And we're representing three of those three men. The three of them are identified in the Senate report itself. The lead plaintiff is Suleiman Abdallah. He's a Tanzanian citizen. He was abducted in 2003 by the CIA, and he was flown in a circuitous route to Afghanistan and detained by the CIA for a year and a half. But for the first month or so of his capture by the CIA, he was held in a prison that's named Cobalt in the Senate report, and he was subjected to techniques, torture methods that had been devised by James Mitchell and Bruce Jessen to destroy him psychologically. And their theory was that once they're destroyed psychologically, they're put into a state of what the psychological profession call learned helplessness. Once put into that state, it was their belief that they could render that human being compliant to an interrogator's demands for information. So by torturing them, you could make them provide you with information. So Suleiman was subjected to a series of highly coercive methods for a one-month period. He was he didn't sleep for that whole month. The facility itself was what one CIA interrogator has described in the Senate report as a dungeon. It was medieval. It was pitch black for 24 hours a day. He didn't know night from day. There was excruciatingly loud music played, you know, at all, again, 24 hours a day for the full month he was there. He wasn't permitted to sleep. He was chained in contorted stress, so-called stress positions. He wasn't questioned for the first week that he was held there, but then he was subjected to a barrage of torture techniques, including being stuffed inside a small 3-foot square box and doused in ice cold water until his temperature, you know, dropped to a critical level. He was hung in a room for 5 days and kept without sleep. And the other two individuals who we represent were subjected to much the same techniques, again, all devised by Mitchell and Jason.
Can you give me the names of the other two?
Yes, so the lead plaintiff is Suleiman Abdallah, and the second plaintiff, second man, is Mohammed Ben Saud. And the third, should tell your listeners about, Gul Rahman, was tortured to death in that same facility. For 2 weeks, he was tortured by CIA operatives under the instruction of Bruce Jessen. And he was found dead in his cell one morning. And Gul Rahman's body, his family have never been notified of the death, and his family have never received return of the body. So he was a victim of the program. The other two are survivors.
And I wanted to let people know that on the ACLU.org, if you go to it and click on this subject, the lawsuit, there is a video of Suleiman Abdallah, and it's really wonderful to watch. I know some people hear the words torture and those kinds of things, and they want to avoid it, but you just come away with the impression of what a sweet man he is.
Yes.
And a fisherman who loves to fish, and how tortured still today he is by, racked by flashbacks and memories, and, you know, including all the senses type things that you get with that. The smell of things can set him off, and it can remind him of the torture and can make it very hard for him to exist. But still, I say, watch the video. He's a sweet man. It'll give you the reality of the humanity of who we're talking about. None of these men were ever charged or convicted of any crimes, and the government no longer maintains that any of them did commit crimes. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, Suleiman himself was provided. He was held, as I said, by the CIA for a year and a half. He was never charged. And then he was handed over to the US military and was held in the Bagram Air Force Base, also in Afghanistan, for a further 4 years incommunicado detention. And when he was released in August of 2008, the U.S. military gave him a document which says, we do not suspect you of any terrorism against the United States, and there are no charges pending against you.
And so the ACLU is choosing this method to try to get some accountability for the actual victims of torture. Some of us may wonder, and if you're not as cynical as me, you may wonder why we don't try to take this to to an international court. We're signatures to international courts that make the treatment that devised by James Mitchell and Bruce Jessen clearly it's illegal. But I always answer that with my own head, but that would mean we'd have to take the U.S. government to court, and that is not something that's likely to happen in a world that's still dominated militarily and economically by the United States. Is that the reason you didn't try to go those kinds of ways?
No, I mean, we've been pushing for many years now, and since the Senate torture report came out, for the appointment of a special prosecutor to investigate the high-level officials that we know that were involved in the sanctioning of torture. And, you know, and we're still pushing for the appointment of a special prosecutor to be
a U.S.
for these individuals
of the,
to be held accountable under U.S. law.
Uh-huh.
But what this suit is about is the, you know, the two individuals, the two psychologists who were instrumental in the CIA's torture program. And U.S. law actually allows us to bring suits against them. It's, we're suing under a statute called the Alien Tort Statute, which allows non-U.S. citizens to bring suit in civil court for violations of their recognized international human rights protections. And, you know, torture, human experimentation, and war crimes are norms that we can bring in against these individuals in U.S. court. So that's why we're proceeding in U.S. court against Mitchell and Jessen.
And talk a little bit more about what Mitchell and Jessen had done. You know, I Googled human experimentation and or non-consensual human experimentation, and you know, Wikipedia has actually changed in the last 2 days. When you do enter that, what you get taken to, but nonetheless, there's a long list of illegal human experimentation that U.S. doctors and psychologists have participated in over the years, including one in 57 that sounds similar in intent of what James Mitchell and Bruce Jessen was doing. It was something intended to breakdown that doctor called it depatterning, break mm-hmm. down the structure of a person's personality and responses so that they would then be amenable to anything. So talk about James Mitchell and Bruce Jessen, their role, and why yep. it's so important to hold psychologists in particular accountable.
So human experimentation on prisoners, it's a practice that's been banned since the Nuremberg trials that followed the Second World War. And Mitchell and Jessen, and this again is based on the Senate Torture Report, our reading of that document. Mitchell and Jessen, they relied on experiments from the 1960s. And in these experiments, researchers taught dogs to become, and I quote, helpless. And how they did this was by subjecting them to uncontrollable pain to create... and relying on their understanding of these experiments, they created a torture program which had a scientific veneer. And according to their theory, if human beings, and these experiments had never been tried on human beings for the reason that you can't torture a human being and you can't do that either legally or ethically. But according to their theory, if humans are psychologically destroyed through torture and other forms of abuse, they'll become totally compliant in their interrogation, though unable to resist their interrogator's demands for accurate information. So that was their theory, and that's the theory that they sold to the CIA and that the CIA effectively bought into. And the whole so-called interrogation program that the CIA ran with the assistance of Mitchell and Jessen, with their guidance, it was based on this experiment. The notion that you could torture persons into providing you with information.
And the reason we say they were experimenting is because they were literally in the room, them personally in the room, but then also, you know, the protocols were keeping notes on everything. I know that in Guantanamo, they still keep notes mm-hmm. on exactly how much water it took when they're doing, when they're messing with people who are on hunger strike. They do measurements. They write them down. They have medical personnel write them down, and they use those to guide them in the effectiveness of their treatment of these individuals. I've thought from the beginning there had to be, you know, they had to be keeping detailed notes because their, you know, their veneer of science requires that they say, no, if you put this much in, they die. Apparently, Gull Rockman was one part of that experiment that told them a limit they couldn't go past.
Yeah, and here's Linda. Here's what's sort of key to their experiment, and it's a slightly nuanced understanding of what their experiment was to the one that you have just described. But what they were doing was, so they believed that if you induce what's called this psychological state of learned helplessness, if you induce that in a human being, in order to induce that into a human being, you have to sort of calibrate the torture. You have to assess whether or not they've reached that state or not. And if they haven't reached that state, then you're going to have to introduce new forms of torture to get to that state. So there was this continual ongoing assessment of detainees to determine whether or not they had reached this state of so-called learned helplessness. So that was their experiment. And they would refine and recalibrate it, as the torture progressed. If the person hadn't reached that state of learned helplessness, they would be tortured further. So they would progress through what you can read from the Senate report, a phased program of interrogation, a phased program of torture.
And these two men were paid, at the least they had a contract for $81 million to develop this program.
So initially the two were hired as independent consultants to the CIA. So they were independent consultants, Mitchell, from 2002 through until 2005, and they were being paid $1,800 tax-free a day as consultants to the CIA. And then the program had grown to the point that they formed a company, Mitchell, Jessen & Associates, in 2005. And that company, from 2005 onwards until the end of the program in 2009, that company was paid a total of $81 million. And that company and its staff, including Mitchell and Jessen, were responsible for running the entire interrogation or torture program, I would call it, a torture program, including the rendition aspects of it. So they were responsible for the facilities, for the rendition of detainees into those facilities, and for the experiment, for the continuation of the experiment itself.
Wow, so talk about government privatization. That's significant. I didn't realize that they had that much oversight and control.
Yes, they did, from 2005 onwards.
They also had top leaders in the Association of Psychological, what am I trying to say? The psychological.
The APA?
Yeah, the APA. They had top leaders of the APA involved in, one was an investor in that company, I believe, but were involved in trying to, and did succeed to some degree in rewriting and repositioning rules within the APA to allow psychologists to participate in these kinds of interrogations, because it certainly wasn't them only participating in interrogations. And so their role, they begin to sound more and more like Mengele, the famous Nazi doctor, especially when you understand that they wanted to be in the room, or they were in the room for some of the best known tortures, if that's how you can discuss it. What do you hope to, let me restate this. I wanted to say, let everybody know, I'm talking to attorney Stephen Watt of the ACLU, who is a lead attorney on the lawsuit against James Mitchell and Bruce Jessen on behalf of, one victim who died from it, and two living survivors of their torture, who are, one is released now. So what do you hope to accomplish? I mean, part of it, of course, is to reveal to the world through this process of a lawsuit what role these men played and what our government used our tax dollars for. But what do you hope to accomplish with this lawsuit?
So this lawsuit is about ensuring that those responsible for torture are held accountable, and sort of more broadly that history doesn't repeat itself. So when we have the next, international crisis, that we don't resort to the use of torture and we don't damage men like Suleiman and Mohammed and Gul Rahman in the process. And what we found that, impunity for torture, it's damaged the integrity of our justice system and U.S. credibility in the world. And it sends a dangerous message that the CIA and their contractors are exempt from the law. And the lack of accountability for breaking the law, it sends this dangerous message to U.S. and foreign officials that there'll be no consequences for future abuses. But what this lawsuit is about, too, is about justice for torture survivors. Both Mohammed and Suleiman are, and as you see from the video, Suleiman is still very damaged by what happened to him. And he needs to get back on his feet, him and his family, likewise with Mohammed. And there needs to be, you know, compensation for rehabilitation for these guys. You know, both have difficulties holding down jobs, providing for their families. And, you know, they were horrible. You know, that's as a direct consequence of the torture and the methods that Mitchell and Jessen devised. There has to be some compensation. But first and foremost, there has to be an apology and an acknowledgement of what happened happened to them.
I think that's really important, too, because there is the dehumanizing aspect of just saying you're someone we can do this to and then throw away.
Yeah.
Which I can't imagine living inside of that experience for the many victims of U.S. torture. Do you have any hope that this will prevent ongoing forms of torture? Like, I feel that what happens in Guantanamo right now with forced feeding of hunger, well, that is an international law against force feeding those who are on hunger strike.
Linda, yeah.
And I'm sure that there's experimentation still going on. There's still people carefully taking notes about what works, what didn't work, when should they have stopped, when shouldn't they have stopped. Mm-hmm. Reviewing different forms of treatment. I do believe they still use things like, you know, greater amounts of cold or light or taking away possessions, those kinds of things. So we have very little glimpse into Guantanamo at this time. Do you hope that this will in any way affect psychologists participating in that kind of thing? Obviously, the APA has now banned them participating in any way in these interrogation. I assume they banned them from the being involved in the force feeding as well.
Yeah, that's right. They're not what the APA did, and I thought that was, you know, that's what this government should do. What the APA did was a thorough investigation of the organization and its members' involvement with the U.S. military and with the intelligence agencies. And there was an extensive report, some 900-page report. It's called the Hoffman Report that mm-hmm. was produced, which identifies the individuals responsible for that collusion with the U.S. military and the intelligence agencies in torture, and it sort of mapped out a way forward for the organization to address the issue of torture. And what they came up with at their latest meeting, which was just a couple of months back, was that members of the APA can no longer be present in any form of an interrogation. They cannot, represent the United States officials or the like in those interrogation processes.
I heard a video of one of the leaders of the APA movement to end the participation in interrogations, and he said that he wants psychologists and medical personnel as well to know that they have their back, that the association will now have their back when they refuse to participate in these engagements. And you should think that many psychologists don't go into the military thinking that they're going to be involved in torture, but thinking that they're going to be helping soldiers.
Yes, exactly.
Who are suffering rather than committing suffering. And now they have some backup, because once you're in the military, boy, you pretty much take your orders or you can go to the brig.
Yeah, and... Well, you know, what Mitchell and Jessen did was, you know, they're both psychologists. They're both trained psychologists, and they turned the principle, you know, the guiding principle of all psychologists and the medical profession is do no harm. They turned that on its head, and it was about doing harm. And what the APA had done by, you know, banning any of their members from participating in interrogation, in any interrogation, is in a very important step forward.
They also banned them from participating in anything where the conditions of the person that they were subject to were illegal. So they even went so far as to say, you don't have to be involved in any kind of torture with them, but you cannot be involved with them at all when they are in conditions that are illegal.
Yeah, and that's appreciating that, you know, even the conditions of an interrogation, they can amount to violations of human rights. They can be cruel, inhuman, or degrading in and of themselves.
Yes. Well, you know, we're at 9:29 right now. I want to let the listeners out there know that they can call in and speak to Stephen Watt, the attorney here for the ACLU, on this case. Ask him about the men, ask him about the case, or please comment. The number is 503-231-8187. And so we'll begin taking your calls as soon as you start calling in. I know our engineer, Kate, is there ready to answer the phone for you. At least she looks very ready and awake. So let's go on talking, though, while we're waiting for callers to come in. One of the things that I was amazed about was how thorough and damning the reports were, both the CIA torture report out of the Senate and this Hoffman report. What did you think about that? And was it only having that CIA report that allowed you to have the evidence to go forward with a lawsuit like this?
Yeah, so, I mean, what the Senate report is, it's actually the executive summary. It's over 500 pages long, very detailed, but off a much larger report. The actual report itself is some 6,000 pages in length. So there are significant amounts more detail in that report, and we're actually pushing for the U.S. Congress to declassify that full report so that we've got a full accounting of what happened, not just the executive summary. But that said, you know, there's sufficient detail in the executive summary there for us to identify Mitchell and Jessen's role in the CIA torture program and the CIA's role in that same program. There's sufficient detail for us to make the allegations that we have in our complaint and to move forward. I mean, our three plaintiffs, Mohammed, Suleiman, and Gul Rahman, are all identified in that report, as is some of the torture methods that were employed against them. So for them, that is, you know, that transparency of the executive summary in and of itself is helpful to them in their recovery process. But still, it's not sufficient. We need the full report, and also there needs to be, you know, true accountability, not just transparency. There needs to be compensation paid, and there needs to be apologies made.
All right. It sounds like we've got a caller on the line. It's Chris.
Yeah.
Hi, Chris. Go ahead.
Hi. What I wanted to ask, Stephen, is that his name?
Yes, Stephen Watt.
What I wanted to ask is, does public pressure help in you reaching justice?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, the reason for the... Linda mentioned the video. I think the video is probably more accessible to the public, and it really describes what our lawsuit is about, more accessible to the public than our legal complaint, although I would encourage you to read that too. But putting pressure on the U.S. government to hold these two men accountable outside of this lawsuit is really important, and it's also important to our clients too to know that there is support out there, not just from the lawyers here at the ACLU, but the general public, which I think there is.
You know, I would like to say also, Chris, I was in reading up for this show, I came across Jay Lifton. He's an important author, and he was writing on, his name is Robert J. Lifton, author of The Nazi Doctors, and he and other books like that. And one of the things he talks about is how norming something. So we've been normalizing torture in this society for the last 10 years. Every time accusations have come out, we've had top leaders come out and defend them. Cheney and others will be on talk shows saying that these are the appropriate ones and they're not really torture. They're just, you know, they make up these euphemisms for what they really are. But the problem with that is we all begin, you know, all of us are naturally inclined to want to go with the norm, to be like our fellow humans. And so it begins to change the way we all respond to the thought of torture and to the thought of our government doing it. And we have TV shows like Homeland that win awards and Madam Secretary, and invariably they involve torture and the justification of torture. So I think for people like you, Chris, and people like me to be public about it, to call our representatives to take actions publicly really makes a difference, because we need to be shouting loud and clear, no, this is not all right. They're not our heroes and not our celebrities when they do these kinds of actions on people.
Yes.
Yeah.
Am I on?
Yes, you are.
Oh, I just wanted to say, I really think besides calling public officials in that, I think even more important is public spectacle and putting it in right in the face of the public, because I just have felt that, well, for one thing, that our justice system is really sick and broken. I know that because of what's gone on with Black Lives Matter and how few white people realized what black people have to go through on a daily basis, and then the public, how it got out in the public sphere, the way that parts of the country especially treated with endless fines and imprisonment and just destroying their lives, I think a lot of people are, you know, they're caught up in consumerism and infotainment and that. And
when you talk about public, let me interrupt you for a second. When you talk about public spectacle, are you talking about like when people put on the orange jumpsuits and a black mask over their head and stand?
Absolutely.
Those and kinds of actions?
Even the more truthful and upsetting aspects of this whole war on terrorism. It's sick, and it really bothers me. And I as a citizen love knowing what my government is actually doing.
Yes, and that's an important point as well, is that they've attempted to keep it secret. I'm going to thank you for your call, Chris. I'm going to take that a little bit different direction. One of the things that I noticed, Stephen, was that in terms of normalizing torture, normalizing the mistreatment of prisoners, we change their name, they're detainees, they're not prisoners, etc., is that on TV, when they do this kind of thing, it begins to affect people. And I'm wondering how much you think getting out the actual information, like when I see the video of Suleiman, you know, they talk about these people that were released from American prisons and how they were with Guantanamo. They say the worst of the worst, but these men weren't even at Guantanamo. They were at other prisons. But they'd like us to think that if they released them, they're going to go right to war against the United States. What's your experience of talking with and being with these men? Are they likely to go to war against the United States again? Well, they never were.
I've met Suleiman. I've met Mohammed. I've met over the years, you know, I've been working on cases similar to this, you know, seeking accountability for survivors of torture and inhumane treatment for some 10, 12 years now. And every one of them, they're not soldiers. They're just human beings. Who were, some of them, you know, in the U.S.'s view, were in the wrong place. And they were in the wrong place at the wrong time and picked up and just swept up into the, you know, the torture machine. And what the government has done a very good job is, as you've mentioned, Linda, of dehumanizing these individuals, of, you know, branding them as, you know, and that's Rumsfeld words for the Guantanamo detainees when they were first brought there. That's the worst of the worst. And if the American public actually got to meet these people and, you know, sat opposite Suleiman and hear his story, sit opposite Mohammed and hear his story, and, you know, Gul Rahman's family, you know, I was the first person to tell them the circumstances of their, you know, their father, their uncle, their husband's death, the circumstances. And
you knew it because it came out in a report.
That's correct. Yeah, it came out in a report for the U.S. Senate. I think that's, you know, humanizing these people and showing the American public that, you know, these are human beings. You know, and even if they are charged with a crime, you don't torture them.
No.
I mean, our guys are innocent of any wrongdoing, as are many of the men that are named in that in the Senate report, all 119 of them. But none of them deserve to be tortured. I mean, that's just not American. And it's, you know, at the end of the day, it's also not an effective means of going about gathering intelligence.
Well, I think that was one of the most, startling that Feinstein said it. But one of the things that Senator Feinstein said was that she could not find one case where out of these tortures, where it made any difference in stopping any kind of crime at all. And these two psychologists had no training in interrogation. They had no experience in interrogation at all. They were able to develop a crude method of damaging humans without any benefit of intelligence. I don't think we should try to damage humans to get intelligence anyway, even if they have some intelligence. But even if they did, the methods they used were proven not to be effective in any way at all. I would hope that would make us not use them again.
Yeah, ineffective, but also, and I think more importantly, illegal and amoral.
Yes, exactly. You know? We know they're crimes against humanity, and I at least think that post World War II, it felt like in this country anyway, we had rebuked that. I say it felt like that. I wasn't born during World War II, but I was certainly a post World War II person, and I know I grew up hearing about the horrors of the Nazi doctors and the incredible things they did to prisoners.
Yeah.
And that seems to not be quite so in the foreground as time has gone on. It's now 9:41. If you want to call and be on the air, the number to call is 503-231-8187. And we have Mitch on the line.
Yes, thanks for having this show, and really appreciate Mr. Watt laying out the ACLU case. Before the ACLU came on the scene, there was quite a bit of alternative press digging into Mitchell and Jessen's operation in Spokane.
Yeah, it's in Spokane, our wing of the country.
And I tried going to our two, we're blessed in Portland by having two alternative press weeklies, and also contacting KABU to see who was going up when the report first came out in the mainstream press. I think the New York Times had a front page story about the Spokane operation that was left to then, instead of generating a packed journalistic response of having everybody flood Spokane to find out how these people came to set up shop there and where all this money was flowing from to support their operation. Instead of that happening, which one would expect, the opposite happened, and it all got shut down. And I didn't find any journalistic inquiry at all. And I tried finding out even from Yanka Soderberg at KABU, but also from the two weeklies, why there was no more digging going on, since this was a Northwest story, Spokane. I mean, not right. It's not Kitty Corner.
No, it isn't Kitty Corner, but it is. I'll let you know that back a few years ago when I had my program, A Deeper Look, I did look up where their office at headquarters were and they're near a military base, and that's where part of their operations are there. But then later I heard that they no longer kept an open office there. I never did make the trip up because I couldn't quite figure out an angle about how I would approach getting into the building. But anyway, yes, I hear what you're saying. It's a local.
Could Mr. Watt address the issue as to how they came to set up shop there?
I think they came to set up shop there because there is a military installation there, and they were working directly with that.
So then they were private contractors working under the military.
Say that again.
They're private contractors
working with the military.
Okay. Who's the client of who? Is the military the client of Mitchell Jessen, or is Mitchell Jessen the client of the military?
Well, it's the Mitchell Jessen, the client is the military. The client is the U.S. government.
Okay, because I think what's getting lost here that I was hoping Mr. Watt could clarify was something that might help shine a light on this whole privatization of our intelligence apparatus in this country.
Yeah, so let me just sort of clarify a couple of points. So Mitchell and Jessen were psychologists, and they were independent consultants initially with the Central Intelligence Agency, with the CIA. So they weren't independent contractors to the military.
Mm-hmm,
and
thank you.
They were responsible for the devising of the CIA's torture program, not the military. But both Mitchell and Jessen spent time in what's called the SAIR program, which is survival. I always get the acronym wrong. Survival.
It's S-E-R-E,
invasion,
isn't it?
An escape program, the U.S. military's program. And both were at one point working as psychologists in that program in Fairchild in Spokane. So they were employees of the military, as it were. But in devising the torture program for the CIA, they were consultants with the Central Intelligence Agency.
And Mr. Watt, did it seem odd to you that the spokesman, before the New York Times ran the spokesman's reporter's work, that the spokesman reporters, you know, a local regional newspaper, would have received absolutely no plaudits around the world for breaking a story like that?
I don't know. I didn't know they did.
Yeah, I've read that lengthy investigative piece that was done at the time. It was a great piece, and it was actually, you know, we used it in putting together our case against Mitchell and Jessen.
Yeah, I'm still mystified at the real-time lack of follow-up, because I had a full-time job at the time, and I was trying to, and yet I was finding no one thought this was anything worth pursuing.
Well, I think mainstream media isn't interested in it, and I think one of the things that slows down stuff with KBOO is that we are volunteer. So most of the people who are doing programs like me or you here on the air have other day jobs as well. So and receive no pay or compensation.
And I definitely appreciate that, because
yeah.
I've never gotten to make my living as a journalist either, and so I've worked for community radio here and in other cities. I understand that. What I don't understand, because in the Bay Area there's a great symbiosis between KPFA and what were the alternative press papers there at the time, and there were three of them in the Bay Area. I don't find that here. I don't find KBOO news people calling up the Mercury or the Willamette Week, and the Willamette Week has done amazing work this last year, bringing down a sitting governor and exposing the DHS problems with the foster care homes. It's one story after another where they have gotten amazing results. I don't see KBOO working in symbiosis with the alternative press.
Well, you know, I appreciate you bringing that up, and I can't address it fully. I do know that we do have people who work directly with Mercury and collaborate and talk with them. But I'm going to let you go at this time. I want to thank you for that, and I want to say that should spur our audience onto wanting us to do more investigative reporting, and I agree with you. That would be great. We do have another caller on the line. His name is Russ. I'm sorry, I didn't hear that name.
This is Barth.
Oh, hi, Barth. Thanks for calling.
Oh, sure. I always enjoy your shows. This is a strong thing, a nice KBOO subject, because it gets the word out there and makes it understandable and approachable to people. The idea of torture is abhorrent, I think, on a visceral level to most people, and most Americans would say, we're not that kind of people.
Yes, I agree with you. That's how I grew up. We're not that kind of people.
Yeah, this unfortunately proves that because of the choices of our governance, we are that kind of people. And unless we do something about it, we will get worse. You talked about being a child of post-World War II and that there was much revulsion about torture based on the things that came out of the Nazi history and the death camps and all of those things. Another strong anti-torture push was Korea, because the Chinese and the Koreans were doing these similar kinds of tortures without as much psychological finesse, you know, water torture and deprivation and extreme cold, and those kinds of things were stock in trade for breaking troops, Allied troops.
And we engaged in, the U.S. government did at some point engage in some brainwashing experiments trying to duplicate what they thought the Chinese were doing.
Yes, there was a whole chapter about that with mind control and been some various movies about that. But I just wanted to bring that up and to thank your guests for coming and helping illuminate this subject, and I wish him great luck in his efforts.
Thank you. And we have Christy on the line.
Hi there.
Hi, Christy.
Oh, hi.
Crystal, I'm sorry.
Yes. I have a question about two connections here in, well, near us in our locality, and I was wondering if you, Linda, or Mr. Watt could speak to them if they were included in the Senate report or any of the 900-page report regarding the OHSU doctor, psychologist that was involved, and one of the reasons the APA has are no longer endorsing it. And the other one was the Evergreen Aviation in McMinnville. I understand that that man was involved in transferring prisoners to black sites in Poland specifically.
And the psychologist at OHSU that you're talking about, say that again?
Yeah, if you or Mr. Watt know about those two incidents, these are local connections we have with the torture and the extraordinary rendition and disappearing in black sites.
Well, yeah, go ahead. Steve Watts, do you have any information about this?
I mean, I haven't, you know, I've read the executive summary of the Senate's report in great detail, but I was looking at it specifically in relation to Mitchell and Jessen's role in
yes.
the program. I hadn't, you know, are you talking about a connection between Portland, Oregon?
Yes, here at OHSU, the Oregon Health and Science University. There was a psychologist involved in, I think it was related to Guantanamo specifically, and then Evergreen Aviation is the airplanes. I understand he's had to shut it down, but it's still open as a museum in McMinnville.
The airlines, yeah.
The Senate report that we're talking about this morning, that addresses the CIA's program, not the military's program. So that's not to say that there isn't a connection in, or that connection might be made in another report, a report by the Senate Armed Services Committee from 2009. I haven't looked at that one in as much detail, but the full report's available online.
And then the thing to do would be to try to do a search for, you know, Evergreen itself or that psychologist's name, and we might be able to find out more. I know that Evergreen was supposed to be involved in renditions. They've now been closed, and there's a lot of other kinds of controversies around them. Thanks for bringing up those local issues. Also, I did many years ago try to interview the head of the Oregon Psychological Association, and I spoke with her at length. It was a woman at that time. She did not want to go on air about the controversy at that time about whether the APA was allowing psychologists to participate in illegal activities. And then I spoke to one man who had worked with the military, a psychologist here who was also a member of the APA, and he was very much just denying that they were doing anything wrong and that they would be involved in torture at all. It would be interesting to get back to the Oregon Psychological Association and see what they had to say. I think their main point was they wanted to keep away from it and try to stay like clean, not tainted by it, because they have many other activities that are completely unrelated. But I think it would be good to find out their stance on the latest APA findings and their actions. So thank you for that, Crystal. I believe we have another person on the line. Hi, this is Linda. Your name is?
Ron.
Juan?
Ron.
Warren. Thanks for calling, Warren. What would you like to say?
I was wondering if he was aware of the high-value detainee that they went on trial a couple years ago. His name was, it started with Sheikh. I can't remember the whole name. At any rate, in 2004, NPR did a program on a tool that they had some psychologists develop called the Word of God. And this sheikh said that when he came into Guantanamo, that he had a dream, and in the dream it told him to, Allah told him to tell the truth. So he told them the truth, and then they waterboard him approximately some 100 times. I was wondering if he was aware of this tool, because they use it in the public, in the society. And so the torture extends even further than just the military and the terrorists, that kind of thing.
What is the tool you're talking about? You said Word of God?
Yeah, the military calls it the Word of God. They put you in a subconscious state while you're asleep, and they pump some information or whatever they want to you, and you wake up thinking that you had a dream. And so this sheikh thought he had a dream, and in the dream, God told him, or Allah, rather, told him, to tell them the truth.
Stephen, have you heard of this particular case?
No, this isn't ringing any bells for me, although it may be. I know that Mitchell and Jessen were involved in certain interrogations, and that's disclosed in the Senate report, including Abu Zubaydah, the torture of Abu Zubaydah, rather, and also the torture of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. And he was waterboarded 183 times. And, you know, the methods that Mitchell and Jessen had devised and that were sanctioned by lawyers, senior level lawyers, for use on Abu Zubaydah were also used on Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. But I'm not aware of that particular method.
All right. Well, thank you. You know, we only have a couple minutes left, and so do we have another caller on the line? No, we don't. So I won't encourage you to call because we only have a couple minutes. I want to thank you, Stephen. This has been a really important discussion. What do you hope that, one, tell us the court that this case will appear before, and when you expect us to know more about it as it goes forward?
So we filed in the federal court in Spokane. It's the Eastern District of Washington, mm-hmm. In Spokane, and we were contacted by the defendant's lawyer. So we'll negotiate a time for a briefing and the like. So it'll be progressing forward. They had, you know, 21 days. We've agreed that they will take longer than that to respond to us. But it'll progress in the courts, and it'd be great if you could keep your listeners appraised of how things develop.
Yeah, and so I would be able to, and so would the public be able to find updates on the ACLU.org site?
That's right, www.aclu.org. And there's the video and the like, if you can find that, and also information on this case specifically. You've got a whole page devoted to that, and it's aclu.org/darkness.
Darkness, yeah.
Yeah.
Great, because I find when I can see and hear a person, you know, it takes away any of the mystery. They're no longer a stranger. And so I encourage everybody who does have a computer or access to computer to go ahead and go to the ACLU.org. You'll see the subject coming across on the homepage, you know, right away within seconds of going to that page. Once again, thank you so much, Stephen Watton. We will be paying attention. Maybe we'll get to see you up in Spokane sometime when this case actually is being heard. So thank you again for joining us here on KBOO.
Thank you again, Linda.
And I want to thank all the listeners. Our engineer this morning was Kate Wells. I want to thank her, and I want to thank all of our intelligent callers and all of our intelligent listeners. Thank you for being part of the KBOO community.
15 degrees, a cloth is placed over the detainee's face. Cold water is poured on the cloth. The wet cloth creates a barrier through which it is difficult, or in some cases not possible, for the detainee to breathe.
And it is just a few seconds before 10 a.m. Stay tuned for Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, Flashpoints features a talk by noted author and radical historian Vijay Prasad on the Middle East. And at 11, the KBOO Food Show looks at a touring exhibit called Inheritance Stories, which features food stories from the Latino community in Oregon. We'll hear stories from the closing, the Hunger Gap Conference of the Oregon Food Bank, and we hear a conversation with Andrew Moore, author of Papa, In Search of America's Forgotten Fruit. Thanks for listening to KBOO. Thank you, KBOO members, for your support. To become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today. You are tuned to KBOO Portland.
Start your Saturday morning with a little swingin' country. The KBOO Swingin' Country program will be broadcasting live from the Tin Shed Garden Cafe on Saturday, October 24th, from 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. I know you've been hankering to put a face to those velvety tones, so here's your chance. You are welcome to come early, pull up a chair, and enjoy some coffee, food, and an earful of swinging country. The Tin Shed Garden Cafe is located at 1438 Northeast Alberta Street in the City of Roses.